From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. Democratic state lawmakers unveil a $100 billion stimulus plan for California, but how will we pay for it? I'll have details. Meanwhile, the pandemic made a pause for pro sports. We'll hear from one man who says now's the perfect time to rethink the games we love. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. Thank you for joining us this Monday. Coming up, Hollywood keeps getting creative about how to do business. Oh, and that potential blockbuster, Tenet, we keep talking about, it's back on for a release date. That's ahead. But we start today with an eye on Sacramento, where if you listen closely, you might hear this song. Bills. Bills, more bills. Destiny's Child is part of a long-standing tradition here on Take Two. All right, it's probably a lot less musical, but California lawmakers are back at work today, remotely, of course. They'll have about 5 weeks to get through a stack of important proposals, several of which deal with some pretty hot-button issues in California. Worker protections in the time of COVID-19, as well as bills dealing with racial justice and policing. So, with that August 31st deadline in mind, let's learn a bit more about what lawmakers will consider. With me to talk about that is Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Happy Monday, Marisa.
Glad to be here with you.
We had you Friday. We get you back again today. Always a joy. Before we get into those bills in question, Marisa, I do want to actually look at some late breaking news from the Senate. Democratic lawmakers there have unveiled a $100 billion coronavirus stimulus plan. What do we know about that right now?
Well, it's a very rough outline so far, a couple pages, but we know that they are essentially looking to borrow against future tax revenues and other sort of pots of money, securitizing some revenue streams ahead of time. And they want to do this because, of course, the state cannot print money like the feds can. They're saying that this package would include support for small business, like tax breaks, unemployment insurance exclusions so that small businesses don't have to pay for UI. Things like eviction protections, filling the gaps that might be left by the feds when that unemployment money does run out at the end of the month if they don't act, which we're still waiting on, and investments in a green economy, including things like wildfire prevention and things to improve clean water delivery. So kind of a Christmas tree here. I think understandable that they would want all this, but I think going to raise a lot of questions because we don't have a lot of details yet.
I mean, my understanding is that these future tax vouchers are pretty much a loan on future state earnings. And in my gut, I'm wondering, well, is that responsible policy? But another part of me says that if this is something that's on the table, then the lawmakers have already considered what life would look like here if they don't pass some kind of stimulus. What's your sense on all of this?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's a sort of a series of bad choices for them, right? Nobody, I think, after seeing, what happened during the last recession and all the work that state leaders did to build that rainy day fund we're now tapping into, necessarily wants to borrow against future revenues. I think what they would probably say is that if we don't step in, this could stand to be, you know, a worse economic crisis than maybe even the Great Depression was. And so as people navigate issues like, can I keep working if my kids don't have childcare or school? I think that they're kind of, presented with a series of bad options. And I think what they're betting on is that keeping the economy going would pay off later, even if you're borrowing against some of that future revenue. But it'll be a fight.
Wow, indeed. I'm sure it will be. Well, we'll keep following that. Now, let's dig into some of the bills on the docket, starting with two that could protect workers who are diagnosed with COVID-19. What's that about, Marisa?
Yeah, this is something the governor actually talked about a little last week, not necessarily endorsing these bills per se, but there's one by a Bay Area lawmaker, Senator Jerry Hill, that would essentially make you eligible for workman's compensation benefits if you were infected with COVID-19. Another from State Senator Anthony Portantino down in the Valley down there that would expand paid sick leave for food sector workers. I think that the governor has talked a lot about the need to really protect workers and thereby protect everybody within, a workplace because what he's been really raising concerns about is that people are continuing to go to work even if they're sick or they know they've been exposed because they just don't have the money to stay home.
Now, lawmakers are also considering another much more controversial bill related to the pandemic, and it's been put forward by Democratic Assemblyman David Chu from San Francisco, and it addresses an issue that's probably top of mind for a lot of people right now, and that's evictions. What does he want to do?
Yeah, so he is essentially, you know, we've had a kind of series of both federal and state actions since the pandemic started, emergency actions to prevent eviction proceedings from happening. He essentially wants to keep this going kind of indefinitely during this COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, they basically... landlords couldn't kick people out of their homes. And this is going to be a very controversial issue. What we've seen so far isn't necessarily that landlords can't come back after the emergency protections that have been issued and evict people, but they can't do it while those are in effect. So essentially, Chu wants to expand this quite dramatically.
I mean, it's interesting. Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, he's remarked that the idea of passing a bill like this would have been considered science fiction just 9 months ago. Do you see lawmakers passing something like this, or do you think they might just kind of wait for Washington to move on it?
Maybe all of the above. I mean, I think that David Chu is from San Francisco. He is one of the more liberal members of the caucus. I think it's totally possible that we will see the state try to enact some sort of eviction protections. That was part of that package that we talked about at the top. It may not go as far as someone like Chu would want. But I do think, you know, we are hearing a change on this. We heard a group of property owners, apartment owners last week essentially say the state should expand some of their protections. And I think that there's a real concern on both the mortgage side and the renter side.
This is Austin Cross sitting in for A. Martinez. Marisa Lagos is with me. She's political correspondent for KQED. A changing direction, Marisa. The legislature has been flooded with bills related to policing. Most of them have come about after the killing of George Floyd. Give us a rundown of what's being considered.
Yeah, I mean, we saw after those protests began a handful of bills, one that the governor kind of, again, implicitly endorsed, banning the use of chokeholds, you know, those carotid artery holds that are blamed with George Floyd's death. There's ones around investigations of police and whether, you know, county officials who work with those folks should be in charge of those. A lot around reporting and doing more to kind of measure how departments are doing around the state. And I do think, Austin, that this is an issue that even with COVID still dominating a lot of the conversation is really top of mind. And I do expect that we're going to see, you know, something passed, maybe not exactly what some of the advocates want, but probably to go further than we have in the past.
I was definitely going to ask your sense of the appetite for these
that.
Sorts of things that lawmakers have here. So your take on it, your read on it, and that's certainly what I'm seeing here is that there's quite a bit of appetite for this sort of thing.
You know, there is. I think the fascinating question will be where police unions and chiefs and other law enforcement leaders come down on this. We have seen a lot of movement around the idea that, you know, unions might be more open to things they weren't in the past. But when it comes down to changing, you know, the standard for when you can charge somebody with a crime, going further than some of the questions of tracking, really banning things or mandating things, it's been a little squishier.
Last thing, Marisa, the governor has ordered most school districts in the state to start with distance learning this year. Do you see lawmakers amending the state budget at all to maybe apportion more funds to help out with that?
I think that's going to depend a lot on what happens in Congress this week around all these stimulus conversations and what happens, you know, with things like this proposal to borrow against future revenues. We're already hearing calls from lawmakers that they would like the governor to call a special session so they don't have to do everything by August 31st. But of course, a lot of these school districts start in August. So I think there's going to be a lot of unknowns even for school officials as the fall begins.
I was going to ask Marisa, but really quickly, there's a lot to get through before the end of the month, and Anthony Rendon has maybe tried to get the governor to ask people to come back. Is there any hope of them coming back in person to get through the stack of bills that they've got on their table?
So most of them are back in the Capitol today, and we have a kind of like, it depends on if you're in the Senate or the Assembly, how you can vote if you can't come back for health reasons. I did see some photos today of one 73-year-old lawmaker in a full face shield and this kind of like mask that looked like something out of Batman. But there's an ongoing debate about this question. The Assembly has said in limited circumstances, lawmakers can vote by proxy. The Senate is allowing committee votes from, you know, people's districts. But I think it's going to depend. And we've already seen several lawmakers get sick. So there's definitely concern in the Capitol about the safety of being there physically.
Marisa Lagos is political correspondent for KQED. She also co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown. Marisa, thanks.
Have a good week.
Now to nursing homes. Residents and staff at these facilities continue to be among the hardest hit by the coronavirus. To date, 1,790 residents of skilled nursing facilities in LA County have died of COVID-19. To give us an update on the problem and how officials are handling it, we have KPCC health reporter Jackie Fortier. Jackie, welcome.
Thanks.
Now, for weeks in April and May, nursing home residents and staff made up half of COVID-19 victims in LA County. Is that still the case?
Yeah, unfortunately, that did happen. In California in general, about 40% of all the people who have died from the coronavirus either worked or lived in nursing homes. That is still not the case. The number of deaths have gone down in LA County. There's about 8 people dying every day from COVID-19 in nursing homes. The height of that in May was 25 a day. But I wouldn't really say that the situation has gotten any better, even though the deaths are down, just because there's still hundreds of people who are sick and they get, you know, very severely ill. Across California, more than 18,000 nursing home residents have contracted the virus since January.
What are some of the factors that have led to the outsized spread of the virus in nursing homes, Jackie?
Well, first of all, you have a very medically fragile population of elderly people who are just much more susceptible to infections in general, including the coronavirus. Nursing homes are chronically short-staffed, which can lead to staff cutting corners when attention to things like infection control and protocol is really important, and they are underpaid. They're also undertrained. Nursing homes are not hospitals. The staff is not used to having to deal with real high-level infection controls. These workers may need multiple jobs to make a living, which means a greater risk of exposure to the coronavirus. They may work through an illness as well in order to continue to get paid. There's also inadequate supplies of personal protective gear like masks and gowns that have really compounded the nursing home infection control problems that we've seen.
Yeah, it really sounds like a combination of factors that have come in to make this so dangerous and deadly. What are public health officials and nursing homes doing to try to contain it?
Well, testing is the paramount thing that they're trying to do. In April, LA County Health Department said they were going to test everyone in nursing homes, and then they backtracked. And then at the end of May, the state health department came out with guidelines instructing all of the nursing home facilities in California to test all residents and staff at least once. If a home shows no cases, it must continue to test at least a quarter of residents and healthcare workers on a weekly basis so that everyone gets tested at least once a month. That's the idea. I do think that the data that we get from the reporting from the health department and the county is an undercount. Public health officials have also helped nursing homes by getting access to personal protective gear like masks and gloves. If you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, those were being reserved for hospitals because we thought we were going to see a lot of patients in hospitals. They're still having supply chain problems with PPE, but it's not nearly as scarce as it once was. So they're helping nursing homes get access to that.
I'm talking to KPCC health reporter Jackie Fortier. And Jackie, the LA Times reported on Friday that state nursing home inspectors, the people who are supposed to check on infection control at homes and make sure that residents and staff are as safe as possible, are not being tested for COVID-19. And that seems like an incredibly serious oversight problem.
Yes, it is. Despite requiring routine COVID-19 testing for nursing home residents and workers, we found out Friday that state nursing home inspectors are not being tested. Advocates I talked to were just astounded that the nursing home inspectors, and who go from facility to facility, are not being tested, because we know that this is one of the ways that the virus spreads. The CDC did an investigation back in March into that big outbreak in Washington State that you may remember, and one of the reasons that so many people died was due to workers going to multiple nursing homes. When I asked Governor Gavin Newsom about it on Friday, he told me that he's working on requiring all nursing home inspectors to be tested, but he didn't give any details. In an email, the California Department of Public Health said that to date, 6 state nursing home inspectors have tested positive for the virus, but they said that they had not contracted it at work, meaning in a nursing home, and they had not exposed others to it while they were doing their jobs.
I understand that after months of being closed to visitors at the start of the pandemic, nursing home residents can now receive visitors, which must be a huge relief to family members and people in nursing homes who have had to endure isolation and loneliness. What are the protocols around visiting?
Well, very few are allowing visitors, so most nursing home residents still aren't seeing their loved ones. In order to allow visitors, there cannot have been new COVID-19 cases in the nursing home for 28 days. There are very few nursing homes that fit that qualification. The nursing home can't have staff shortages. They must have adequate personal protective gear, cleaning and disinfecting supplies in order to facilitate these visits. They also have to have adequate access to testing. And they also have to have a referral hospital that has bed capacity, including in the intensive care units, which, as you know, we're seeing less and less availability in ICUs right now because of our surging cases. So those are very high standards that few nursing homes in LA County or even in California in general can meet. Even if nursing homes do allow physically distant visits outside, visitation policies can change if state officials, you know, become concerned about a rise in COVID-19 cases in that area. And individual families and individual facilities are not obligated to open up to families, even when the state says that they can.
If there are people listening who have a family member in a nursing home right now, what kind of information should they be asking for from the home to make sure their loved ones are safe?
You should ask to see the mitigation plan that the nursing home has to have filed with the county. You should ask the nursing home administrator for that. You can look at LA County's health department website to see if there is an ongoing outbreak at the facility. You can search by name, and you can also see how many deaths there have been at that facility. You should also talk to the administrator of the facility and ask them under what circumstances visits will be allowed. Or maybe how you can get a cell phone to your loved one so that you can talk to them. The residents are really usually the best resource to find out what's going on in a nursing home.
It's KPCC's Jackie Fortier. Jackie, thanks for all your work on this.
Thanks for having me.
The end of the month marks the end of the extra $600 a week in federal money that came as part of the CARES Act. So millions of renters, including people right here at home, are wondering how they're going to pay for next month's rent. We'll get an update on where things stand from KPCC housing reporter Matt Tinoco in just a minute. Stay with us.
It's time you went home, Bill Bailey. It's time you went home. You got a woman there that moans the whole night long. No, she said she'd do the cooking, Billy. Said she'd pay the rent. She realizes that she done you wrong, yeah. Stop thinking about that lonely evening that she drove you out with nothing but a fine-tooth comb.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in for A. Martinez. July is coming to a close, and for many people on unemployment, that means the end of the extra $600 a week in federal money that came as part of the CARES Act. That also means that millions of renters in Southern California are asking themselves, how do I pay August rent? KPCC's homelessness reporter Matt Chinoco has been covering the issue. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Austin.
So, Matt, what's the biggest fear right now as we look at the issue of housing at this point in the pandemic?
The worry is that a lot of people could lose that housing, a lot more homelessness on a scale much larger than what we already have here in Southern California. I want to first highlight some numbers from a report released at the end of May by the UCLA Luskin School's Institute on Inequality and Democracy. They looked at how many people applied for unemployment in LA County and then considered how many undocumented laborers LA has. They don't qualify for unemployment, and figured that about 365,000 households could be at risk of eviction due to non-payment of rent during the COVID pandemic. Now, most people, when they lose housing, they won't become homeless. They'll double up or find some other option. But even so, the UCLA scholars estimate that somewhere between 36,000 and 120,000 households could actually become homeless because of the pandemic.
And households mean more than just one person, right? So the number of people who could face being without a roof over their heads is actually much higher.
Yes. So that many more people than just those households, practically. And that includes children. The UCLA academics estimate that there's more than one child per household in those calculations. So even on the low end, scholars estimate that there could be almost 60,000 vulnerable children potentially affected.
Now, I know we had a four-month federal eviction moratorium, and that's ending. But we also have local ones, right? Don't those make a difference at all?
They sort of make a difference, but what they've effectively done is kick the can down the road. Many cities and counties, as well as the state itself, have temporary eviction moratoriums that prohibit eviction for non-payment of rent during the pandemic if a tenant can show that they've lost income because of the pandemic. Those would basically require a tenant to go to court and prove in court that they lost income because of the pandemic, by the way. But there's also another rule from the state's court system that has basically halted all eviction proceedings until 90 days after the emergency is over, which practically that just means that eviction court has been stalled until the pandemic's over, and it's not clear when it's going to resume.
This is Austin Cross sitting in for A. Martinez, and I'm talking with KPCC homelessness reporter Matt Chinoco. But Matt, just to keep in mind here, the rent is still due. It may be deferred, but tenants still have to pay that rent eventually, right?
They absolutely, as it stands right now, will have to pay that rent eventually or face eviction. That's the 365,000 households who will presumably not be able to pay. Consequently, there's a growing chorus that is basically saying rent during the pandemic should just be canceled outright, that tenants who have been missing rent should just be issued rent forgiveness. Obviously, canceling rent is a bit of a political can of worms, particularly because property owners have historically held much more power over local government than tenants. And then there's real practical questions of how you would actually do that, given there are a lot of landlords who are just individuals paying mortgages, and, well, everybody loses if they lose their properties to foreclosure. Practically, nobody thinks that that the state or local government have the resources to cover the rent of tenants who can't pay, or for that matter, the mortgages of landlords who have several tenants missing rent. Though some argue that money could come from defunding the police. But generally, people say that this is something that the federal government should step in and do because they do have the money.
How have landlords been getting money if there's a moratorium on rent? What sort of relief do they get?
Well, I'd want to underscore that for right now, the vast majority of tenants are still paying rent in full. That's what the apartment association says, and national data bears that information out. It is only a minority of tenants that are not actually able to pay in rent full. However, that minority is still hundreds of thousands of people, which practically when it comes to people becoming homeless, that's a big worry. So there are a number of landlords out there who are not getting money from some of their tenants. But the proposals for how you would actually do rent forgiveness would basically come down to landlords would apply for public assistance because it is rental income. You would seek public assistance from the government and say, okay, well, I've lost this much income, then the government would make that up. Or you could, in some cases, do tax credits.
So what's going to happen, Matt? What could prevent this upcoming crisis?
So one of those proposals I kind of mentioned here is it would shield tenants from eviction for non-payment even after the pandemic. But the tenants would still have to repay it eventually. But nothing is set in stone. The few rental assistance programs that tenants have, like the one that opened in LA City earlier this month, they're just nowhere near large enough to meet the amount of need. So the LA City program will offer 50,000 households in the city of LA about $2,000 in rental assistance. 200,000 households applied. And it'll basically be a sort of lottery to decide who will get some of that public assistance. I think it's we don't know what's going to happen, but I do think the only kind of silver lining right now is that evictions just can't happen during a state of emergency, and nobody knows when coronavirus is going to pass, if that's going to be measured in months or years. So it means that there's still some time to chart out an appropriate path before just lifting the eviction moratoriums and wishing those in poverty good luck.
That's KPCC's homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Austin.
Now let's turn to Orange County, where coronavirus continues to affect countless parts of life, from hospitals to schools to government meetings. Nick Gerda has been covering these issues. He's a reporter for the nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC, and he joins us regularly for the OC Update. Welcome, Nick.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Nick, COVID-19 cases in Orange County shot up in recent weeks, bringing it the unflattering distinction of having the second largest caseload among all counties in the state. I break down some of those numbers for us heading into the end of July.
Yeah, so Orange County used to be better than all of the surrounding counties in terms of cases and hospitalization rates, but it has been increasing faster than the surrounding counties, particularly in June. And now today, the number of people hospitalized with the coronavirus in Orange County is much higher than it was a couple months ago. It's lately been holding steady in the last couple weeks at around 700 people hospitalized at any given time with coronavirus here in Orange County. And this is up significantly from 2 months ago when there were fewer than 300 coronavirus patients in Orange County hospitals at that point. So local health officials are keeping a close eye on those numbers, those hospitalizations. And at the same time, there's concern that the pace of deaths has also been rising and is now at the highest rate of the pandemic, about 140 deaths from coronavirus in Orange County over the past 2 weeks. Meanwhile, hospital patients have been moved into long-term care facilities. We've been seeing more of this lately, as well as skilled nursing facilities. And my colleague Spencer Custodio talked with an epidemiologist at UC Irvine, Andrew Neumer, who said those transfers to these longer-term facilities could be one reason why the hospitalizations are remaining relatively steady.
So how does that actually affect the hospitalization rate?
Right. So it kind of begs the question of what we're seeing with the hospitalizations plateauing. If you're having more transfers of hospital patients into these non-hospital care facilities, that can help make those hospitalization counts stabilize, even if patients are flowing into the hospitals at the same higher pace. It definitely helps with hospital capacity to be transferring patients out. But in terms of the spread of the disease and the markers of the spread, we are seeing the highest pace of deaths of the pandemic so far in Orange County.
Well, in regards to OC hospitals and coronavirus, a number of medical workers are protesting the working conditions at Kindred Hospital in Westminster. How long has this been going on, and what are the protesters saying about how the hospital has handled the coronavirus?
Right. So they really came out last week on the heels of workers at several other hospitals in Orange County protesting in the preceding weeks. And my colleagues Brandon Foe and Spencer Custodio covered a worker protest at this Kindred Hospital in Westminster last week. The workers were saying the hospital management's handling of coronavirus patients led to an outbreak among healthcare staff and patients. They were very concerned about. They said that as of last Wednesday, by their count, 16 staffers had caught the virus, as did 12 patients. A couple of local elected officials joined that protest as well. The hospital's owner, Kindred Healthcare, is disputing that, saying that they do follow the CDC safety guidelines and that their top priority is to protect the health and safety of their patients and employees. Meanwhile, the workers are calling for more regular testing of staff, a new unit inside the facility for COVID-19 patients, and more personal protective equipment.
And from what I've read, Nick, the practices at Kindred aren't isolated, and I understand that there have been other protests at other hospitals in the county as well, right?
Right. These are some of the smaller hospitals, not as much the big names in Orange County, but certainly two other facilities in Orange County, two other hospitals have seen protests. Fountain Valley Regional Hospital workers had a similar protest earlier this month. And back in May, hospital workers at Kindred's other location in Brea organized a similar protest about what they say are equipment shortages and infections among staff.
This is Austin Cross sitting in for A. Martinez, and I'm talking to Voice of OC's Nick Gerda. And Nick, the pandemic has had an effect on public opinion as well, really limiting people's ability to voice their thoughts about how things are being handled in the county. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's been really a patchwork of different policies in different local governments. Certainly, you know, addressing local government leaders is a right enshrined in the state law and the Constitution. And since many government buildings closed their doors to the public in March, those opportunities for residents to comment on policy decisions has been limited by a number of different agencies, some favoring only in-person commenters or cutting out comments altogether. My colleague Noah Bashadi had a story on this today and how a lot of OC residents are taking issue with this. Some are accusing city councils and other elected officials of using the pandemic as an excuse to silence dissenting opinions. And legal experts have been wondering if these local officials are circumventing laws on open government and transparency.
Wow. So walk us through some of the different approaches maybe that the districts within the OC are taking to deal with public comments.
Yeah, so the Huntington Beach City Council has among the more varied options for the public. So people can call in from home via a Zoom teleconference system, or they can choose to speak in person. They have some safety procedures in place where people who want to speak in person have to wait outside, and in between speakers, they sanitize the microphone. In Santa Ana, after several weeks of shifting policies, the City Council decided to go with a phone call only policy. Mission Viejo and Irvine choose to just read out comments that the public submits online. And for the sort of the biggest local elected body in Orange County, the County Board of Supervisors, which oversees public health agencies, they were allowing only in-person comments, and it was kind of a room full of people there waiting to speak. And that drew some criticism as skewing comments towards anti-mask activists, and people were concerned to come speak if they didn't want to get exposed. So the county did change that and are allowing comments to be submitted by email and read aloud at the meeting.
All right, Nick Gerda with the Voice of OC talking to us about the latest on what's happening in Orange County. Nick, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Austin.
It is a strange time for pro sports. And as the industry struggles to find its footing, New York Times sports writer John Branch says that the pandemic has provided a rare opportunity to rethink the way teams play and even how we watch sports. Now, I'll tell you, I'm not a huge sports person, but he got my attention. We'll hear from John Branch in 1 minute. Stick around. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. Sports is back. Sort of. Major League Baseball had its opening day last Thursday with no fans in the seats, only cardboard cutouts of those who paid for the privilege. And after the coronavirus interrupted its season, the National Basketball Association will be back this Thursday in a pandemic sort of way. Hockey is next. And football, maybe, if nothing too terrible happens. It's anything but conventional, and there are concerns that the current struggle could hurt some teams over time. So here's a thought. Why not use this moment to rethink how these games are played and maybe make them better? That's the suggestion from the sports desk at the New York Times in a piece titled Sports Have Been on Pause. It's time for a reboot. To discuss this is Times sports writer John Branch. Thanks for coming on the show.
Glad to be here.
Now, before we get into some of the ideas that you laid out, I actually want to get a sense of just how precarious sports is right now. Just this morning, for example, we learned that the Florida Marlins had to cancel its home opener because staff and players have tested positive for COVID-19, and I believe they were traveling. So walk us through how problematic this could get.
Yeah, we knew this was going to be problematic back in March when they shut them down. You know, the easy part was shutting them down. The hard part would be to start them up again. And so it's been in fits and starts. We saw the National Women's Soccer League just conduct a almost month-long tournament in a bubble with no issues that we know of. Mm. So it can be done. Major League Baseball is trying to keep its teams playing at its home stadiums without fans, and they're already struggling with that. And that opens up the question about whether places like the NFL can do it at all.
Let's turn to that article that we called you about, the whole spread about rebooting sports. Since baseball has started, let's start there. And your first suggestion is speed up the game, but for real. And I got to say a big yes on that one. But what were you thinking there?
So we talked about trying to eliminate the mound visits, reduce the warm-up pitches, stick to small gaps between innings, keep the batters in the batting box, keep the pitchers on the pitching mound. Let's get this thing going. I think even last night we saw a Giants-Dodgers game that was several hours long.
Well, the other one that caught my eye is about sticking to the regulated strike zone. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, yeah, it's funny because, you know, the rule book has always said this, and that the strike zone basically goes from the knees up to the chest. But for some reason in Major League Baseball, the unwritten rule is that it's from the knees to the waist. And our thought was just imagine if we actually put the ball in play. If we said the strike zone is going to go all the way up to somebody's chest, people would actually be swinging the bat. The ball would be in play. Of course, there'd be more strikeouts, at least initially. But let's get this game moving. Rather than picking spots around the corners of the plate, wouldn't it be more interesting if people just threw the ball and people swung and hit it?
Now, admittedly, John, I'm not the biggest sports fan, but even I am aware that baseball is one of those sports that people are worried about going forward. And as, you know, energetic as fans can be, interest in the sport has kind of waned over the years. So how do you think this pandemic might hurt the league? And also, would you be so bold as to say that some of your suggested fixes could actually help it get back on its feet after all this is over?
Yeah, I think so. You know, baseball, more than the other sports, is sort of in this strange tug-of-war between tradition and trying to find some young youth blood to reinvigorate it. And it never quite seems to know which direction it wants to lean. But I think baseball needs to come to terms a little bit with how do you get more kids involved? So many things in baseball are done by tradition, including, like, it's not polite. It kind of goes against tradition to, like, flip your bat or to jaw at the pitcher if you hit a home run. You know, you're supposed to act very modest. Kids, and we've seen this in other countries, in places like Japan and South Korea, where baseball is very popular, the fans are very much more active. The game just seems to have a little bit more of an energy to it than it does in the American and National Leagues here.
This is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in for A. Martinez. New York Times sports writer John Branch is with me, and he's reimagining sports during this very rare pause. Now, for basketball, John, you also have a proposal for speeding up the game, or at least taking a few minutes out of it. Explain that for me.
Yeah, in basketball, the biggest complaint that we hear is from fans saying, you know, all you have to do is pay attention to the last 2 minutes of the game. Because that's where all the action is, and the games usually are often close in the last 2 minutes. But the last 2 minutes can take 20 minutes in real time, just because there are so many timeouts, so many changes of possession. It's a ridiculous way to conduct the most exciting part of the game. It'd be like if you're sitting in a movie theater, and right in the climax of the movie, they keep cutting away to commercials. But a lot of our suggestions here, and it applies to this one too, is to keep the fans who more and more are watching these things on TV and try to keep them in the arena. You know, instead of cutting with a minute left in an exciting Lakers championship game and going to some commercial for 3 minutes, keep them in the arena and get the cameras moving around the huddles and around the state or around the arena.
Is it about people being impatient? Because really the people aren't in the arena anymore. So you're trying to actually give that arena experience at home. Is that the thought?
Yeah, I think that's one of our thoughts, because when we think about TV and the way we watch these games on TV, if it's been really the same for the most part for 50 years, I mean, since the advent of television and live sports, and that is, if you imagine like a football game, we watch those football games from a sideline camera, elevated from a distance, and then we watch the play go on, and that these days we get a replay. But maybe this was a time, or is a time, that the NFL or college football can reimagine what's the best angle actually to be watching these? Or can we do more of those aerial shots or those cameras that are up on the wires behind the quarterback or along the sidelines? Just immerse people into it.
Your suggestion about football, it's mainly about safety. And as we know, players are at risk for concussions. So what should the league do to reduce those risks in your view?
Well, it's interesting. And the New York Times has written a lot about concussions, and especially in the NFL. The NFL has started to take that issue much more seriously. But one thing they've never really done, I think, wholeheartedly, is look at helmet technology. They've tried to improve it. A lot of companies are out there trying to create safer helmets. But the football helmet was designed 50 years ago, I guess, 60 years ago, as a plastic shell to prevent skull fractures. It was not used to prevent concussions. And so our thought is that the NFL should take this as a chance to do kind of a moonshot, saying by the end of the decade or by the end of 3 years from now, we are going to have a reimagination of the helmet. And maybe it's not a plastic shell anymore. Maybe it's actually like a big marshmallow type shell, which would perhaps disincentivize people to try to hit other people with their helmet and might be safer for concussions. But the NFL, because it's such a popular league, has never really been incentivized to really reimagine the helmet, which is the same helmet used by college players, high school players, youth players. Now's the time to really take these brain injuries seriously and really reimagine how the helmet is designed.
That's John Branch with the New York Times talking about the article, "Sports Have Been on Pause. It's Time for a Reboot." And John, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you, Austin.
Hollywood has been getting creative about how to survive this pandemic. John Horn has been covering all of it in his podcast, Hollywood, the Sequel. In just a minute, we'll talk to John. And oh, that potential blockbuster, Tenet, we'll have an update on that too. Stick around. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in for A. Martinez. Changes in the film and TV business usually happen pretty slowly, but in this era of the pandemic, we are getting nearly daily news. John Horn is covering all of it for his podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. He joins us every Monday for a preview of the week's episode and to check in on other industry news. Hey, John.
Hey, Austin.
Let's start with some news out of the film world. Today, Searchlight, formerly Fox Searchlight, announced plans for premiering the new Frances McDormand movie in a sort of unprecedented way. What's that story?
Well, typically a movie like this would premiere at one of the big fall film festivals. It might be Venice, it might be Toronto, it might be Telluride. And I think this film was actually invited to all three. And these festivals tend to be kind of friendly competitors. They fight over which movies they're going to show, who's going to get which premiere. But they've decided with this film, Nomadland, which is directed by Chloe Zhao. Her previous films include The Rider, and she's next going to do a big Marvel movie called The Eternals with Angelina Jolie. The festival are going to partner and show this movie not in Venice, not in Telluride, not in Toronto, but at a drive-in in Los Angeles on September 11th. They haven't yet announced where that drive-in is going to be. I certainly want to go show up. They're going to do a live appearance from Chloe and Frances McDormand, who also produced it. But that's their workaround. Telluride is canceled. Venice and Toronto are going to carry on right now with some sort of scaled-down version of what they typically would have offered.
Strange new times call for some really interesting solutions, and that's a pretty cool one, John, I got to say. In other film news, John, there are some developments in what seems like the ongoing saga of Christopher Nolan's movie Tenet. What's the latest on that?
Well, I guess the good news is if you have a passport and you have dual citizenship to Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, South Korea, Russia, Spain, or England, you could go see it.
Oh, great.
The plan, if you don't, you're out. No, you're out. What's going to happen is Warner Brothers has moved this film three times. July 17th, then July 31st, then August 12th. Their plan now is to release the film in some select international territories on August 26th and then bring it to U.S. theaters starting September 3rd. Mm. The real problem is, given where the pandemic is now, I don't think theater is going to be open in a lot of major cities or in early September, including LA and New York. So the idea is they'll get their money out of international territories, which are a little bit ahead of us. Well, pretty much everybody's ahead of us in terms of the pandemic.
Gosh.
And then see what they have to show it in the States. But Christopher Nolan is a firm believer in the theatrical experience. He wants this movie seen in theaters, and he wants to do whatever he can to help theater owners who have gone through the pandemic in a really difficult way, because they have absolutely no income over the last 4 months.
We're talking to John Horn, host of the podcast Hollywood the Sequel, and let's get to this week's episode of your podcast. Who's your guest, John?
We're talking with director and producer Leslie Linka Glatter. She's probably best known for Homeland. She has a long history in not only directing TV, but also as a leader in the Directors Guild of America. And she had finished Homeland, and she was about to head to Budapest to start prep on her next project. It's an 8-part Amazon miniseries called The Banker's Wife, and then everything shut down. And we talked to her recently, and it sounds like, in what she told us, they might be able to restart sometime soon.
We are shooting in 5 different countries and moving all over Europe. Now, Europe has dealt with this so much more effectively than America. So they did not open up before it was safe. So Europe is now looking much more possible. I thought we would be one of the last groups back, the last productions back, and now we're discussing when we can go back.
So, John, does this mean she's getting ready to go into production overseas?
Yeah, and maybe she could see Chris Nolan's film, too, while she's over there. And, I mean, the problem is, obviously, you know, given where the coronavirus is in the States, it's impossible to shoot pretty much anywhere. But there are certain places in Europe, and Netflix has been shooting in Iceland for a while now, where it is safe. The problem is, it's very hard for a lot of people to leave the country and get into Europe if you're an American citizen. So there might be some workarounds that can be done, and there might be some quarantining that happens once you get there. But yes, if you have the potential to shoot in Europe, you're going to be in better position than you would be if you're shooting in the States right now.
Well, this really gets me thinking, John. If production can get back to work in Europe, what do you think that might mean to our local film and TV economy here in Los Angeles?
I mean, it's a huge question, because obviously Hollywood has been fighting what's called runaway production for decades. And first it was places like Canada that offered, you know, incentives or a better currency. And then there were states like Georgia, New York that offered production rebates. But if the safety of the cast and crew is an issue, and you can go film somewhere else cheaply, and maybe the safety protocols aren't as good as they might be here, that's going to be where the real issue is going to be, because everybody wants to get back to work, but they need to go back to work safely. And that's something that Leslie Linka Glatter is involved in, because she's on the Directors Guild of America committee that's looking at what unsafe safety issues might be and how to address them, and how there could be kind of a uniform code of conduct once production does start resuming.
Well, John, I'm wondering if you and Leslie Linka Glatter addressed the issue of equity and who gets directing jobs now that production is resuming in a sort of way. What did she say on that issue?
Well, she says what I think a lot of people are saying, is that she's very hopeful that this is a reset moment, that Hollywood could take a hard look at itself and really challenge its own past practices and do better. But by the same time, if it's trying to be careful and hedge, it's going to end up doing the same things that it's done in the past, which is not take a risk and not hire somebody who isn't a white man. So here's what she had to say about it.
It's impossible to know right now from where we're sitting how that's going to play out. But I do think when there are financial concerns, people become more conservative. And I hope that's not the case with women directors in TV. We've seen really substantive change, and we don't want to slide back with that, but we have a lot of work to do with diverse directors, women and diverse directors in feature films. There's so much more to do.
John, I'm wondering how this story of equity and inclusion will be affected by the sheer fact that the pandemic may affect the amount of productions that can be made. What are your guests saying about that?
Well, there are two things. Certainly, the rules are going to be different, and the costs of addressing on-set safety are going to add a lot of money to production budgets. At the same time, if you're a studio, you want to get a filmmaker who works fast. It might be somebody who has an independent background, who's not used to making big studio films. But also, if you want to make films that are going to speak to the country, you have to hire people who look like the country, not the country club. Mm. And I think there's an economic incentive for Hollywood to cast a wider net. And it has to get past this idea, and Leslie talks about this, that many women would say, they have been told that I hired a woman once as a director and it didn't work out well. Gosh. And of course, they would never say that when they hire a man and it doesn't work out. So Hollywood has to change its thinking and be open to the idea that women are just as good filmmakers as men. And maybe they're actually going to speak to a bigger slice of the population than somebody else could.
Well, John, we'll end with the fact that tomorrow morning, bright and early, the Emmy nominations will be announced. Can you remind us what's planned for the Emmy telecast?
Well, one thing that's unusual about this year's Emmys is because of the pandemic, it is not as bright and early as it used to be. So we used to have to get up at 4 in the morning. They are now starting at the very civilized time of 8:30 a.m. PST. Wow. So you do not have to set an early alarm. And I guess we'll see, you know, based on the nominations, how much of it's affected by voting. But all bets are off. But you don't have to get up super early to watch it. And maybe there'll be some favorite shows of yours. Let's hope Rami gets in. That's what I'm pulling for.
Well, John, I'm really wondering, since I've got a little bit of extra time with you here, I'm just sort of wondering on this equity and inclusion that we've been talking about here. Is there actually any word, though, on is there any idea at all of when Hollywood might actually restart in some substantial ways, or is just all bets off right now?
I mean, they keep looking, and you've heard the expression, I know you're not a sports fan from your previous segment, the shifting goalposts or moving the goalposts, that just like theaters were going to open, you know, in June and then it was going to be in July, there's two pressing issues. One is obviously California and LA County have terrible numbers in terms of new cases and death. So as long as LA County is spiking the way it is, there's no way that production is going to restart here. And then the second question is there still isn't a uniform series of agreements and guidelines of what on-set safety protocols look like. So until there's a uniform plan, and until LA County gets, you know, back in a much better place, I don't see it happening anytime soon. Now, there's certain kinds of shows that are filming. Animation is still shooting. There's some reality programs that are able to take precautions. But in terms of full-scale production, I don't see it happening this calendar year at all.
John Horn is the host of the new LAist Studio podcast, Hollywood, the sequel. The latest episode comes out tomorrow, and you can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. John, thank you so much.
Austin, pleasure talking with you.
It's been a real joy. And just the last few minutes we have left, thank you so much for trusting us with your time. Take Two will be back tomorrow. Josie Wong will be in the hosting chair. I'm Austin Cross. Thank you so much.